This morning we do begin a series called The Road. And we're going to walk through some of the events leading up to the resurrection of Christ, which we'll talk about on Easter Sunday coming up in a few weeks. And on that day, people all around the world are very much focused on Jesus being raised, the temple, or the tomb rather, being empty. And we celebrate anytime that reality is recognized. We celebrate. But this morning, it's, say, Tuesday or Wednesday, and we don't know. The events kind of flow together, so we don't know exactly when the transition took place. But we're around Tuesday or Wednesday of the final week of Jesus' ministry. Now, I don't have to prompt you any further probably with the significance of what happens, because you and I both understand experientially that in the final moments of someone's life, in the final days of someone's life, those are viewed as very significant moments, very significant days. And so the events which transpire in these final days, we pay very close attention to. So it's around Tuesday or Wednesday, a couple of days prior to the Passover, and in that final week, we begin with this story from Jesus' life. Matthew 26, verse 1. When Jesus had finished saying all these things, he said to his disciples, "As you know, the Passover is 2 days away, and the Son of Man will be handed over to be crucified." Then the chief priests and the elders of the people assembled in the palace of the high priest, whose name was Caiaphas, and they plotted to arrest Jesus in some sly way and kill him. But not during the feast, they said, or there may be a riot among the people. Moving on down past the next story to try to complete the saga that's already beginning here. So look at verse 14. Then one of the twelve, the one called Judas Iscariot, went to the chief priests and asked, "What are you willing to give me if I hand him over to you?" So they counted out for him 30 silver coins. From then on, Judas watched for an opportunity to hand him over. Now, the Gospel of Luke tells us that Satan, in the same story, Satan entered Judas. Talk about unwanted guests, right? Or maybe not so unwanted. What we see unfolding here is a moment of decision. Will we choose the Messiah, or will we choose the money? Now, on this table, in a plastic bag, though they didn't have plastic in Jesus' day, right? But this plastic bag allows you to see that in this bag, I have authentic fake money. And the question becomes, will we choose the money, or will we choose the Messiah? The truth is that Jesus is a polarizing figure in society. Now, should we be surprised that in these final moments of Jesus' life that he would encounter opposition? Think about that. And if we look back through some of the things that Jesus said in his ministry, he did say some very challenging, very difficult, decision-challenging things. So, for instance, look in Matthew chapter 10. Matthew chapter 10 and in verse 34. Do not suppose that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I did not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to turn a man against his father, a daughter against her mother, a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a man's enemies will be the members of his own household. Anyone who loves his father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. Anyone who loves his son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. In the Gospel of Luke, chapter 14, beginning with verse 25, he talks about the necessity of counting the cost before choosing to follow him. Large crowds were traveling with Jesus, and turning to them, he said, "If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father or mother, his wife and children, his brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. And anyone who does not carry his cross and follow me cannot be my disciple." Now listen to this. This is where he really zeroes in on counting the cost. Suppose one of you wants to build a tower. Will he not first sit down and estimate the cost to see if he has enough money to complete it? For if he lays a foundation and is not able to finish it, everyone who sees it will ridicule him, saying, "This fellow began to build and was not able to finish." And then he does the same thing with an army. Someone is about to go to war. Wouldn't he first consider whether or not he has enough troops to confront, to face, and to overcome an army which really has more troops? And then Jesus ends this passage in a pretty interesting way in what becomes a repeated phrase. Look there in verse 34. "Salt is good, but if it loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? It is fit neither for the soil nor the manure pile. It is thrown out. He who has ears to hear, let him hear." And it makes me wonder if Jesus is not trying to get our attention and say, look, making a healthy decision as to whether or not to follow him means you stop and you reflect. And if you and I are not willing to reflect on the cost and the responsibility of following him, then we're not only mitigating the decision, but we're not going to follow through with it. We're not going to be devoted to it. Jesus calls us to be devoted, committed followers of his. Amen? But the question becomes, what does that mean? It is not hard to be religious in today's society. Now, religion can be defined a lot of different ways. Just like it's not hard to confess that you believe in God. But we live in a day and time when what God you believe in has to be defined more so than it did 30 or 40 years ago. So Jesus says to his disciples, you need to count the cost. Now one other passage, back in Matthew chapter 8, verses 21 and 22, listen to these challenging words of Jesus. Another disciple said to him, "Lord, first let me go and bury my father." Jesus calling them to follow him, right? That's the context, verse 22. But Jesus told him, "Follow me and let the dead bury their own dead." So here in Jesus' final days, he's encountering opposition. But if we listen to him, if we really listen to him, in his ministry, Jesus said a lot of things which would tend to force people to make a decision as to whether or not to follow him or not to follow him. And some people, obviously some sort of opposition, would end up being engendered by the very fact that he is calling for such serious dedication and commitment. So it probably shouldn't surprise us that he's encountering opposition in these final moments. But what does catch our attention is the gracious hand of God which the enemy meets. Listen to these words from the Apostle Paul as he writes to the church there at Rome. In Romans chapter 5, beginning with verse 6. "You see, at just the right time, when we were still powerless, Christ died for the ungodly. Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous man, though for a good man someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love for us in this: while we were still sinners, Christ died for us." You hear the power of that? You see the graciousness of God coming to the enemy? When all the enemy has a right to expect is condemnation and dismissal, and what the enemy experiences is the gracious hand of God, which on Friday was shaped like a cross, and on Saturday was an open door we call an open tomb that was no longer occupied. Now, if we leave this conversation with the disciples for a minute, and we slip into this conversation going on among the Jewish leaders. Now we go in quietly because we don't want them to know that we're there. We just want to overhear. And so we're there in the room and we're listening and we hear this exchange between the Jewish leaders. This man knows no boundaries whatsoever. He's got to be stopped. He has disrupted the temple process. He has insulted our priests, and he has made us look foolish more than once. What's the name of that guy who lives up the road? Lazarus. That's his name, Lazarus. And the story that's circulating about him dying and being brought back to life by this man, Jesus. I don't know what happened. I really don't care what the story is, but this I know, that the story won't go away. And people are questioning everything that we say and do after listening to him. Rashi, the man's got to be stopped. But how? If we were to walk once again with Jesus through the Gospels, we would see this growing opposition to Jesus. It wouldn't surprise us to encounter this kind of plotting on Tuesday. We would anticipate it, I would think. Throughout Jesus' ministry, we're somewhat conditioned for this type of opposition. It's almost as if, at some point, metaphorically, Jesus sets us down and has a heart-to-heart and says, look, you share my love, you share my mission, you also share my enemies. So listen to me for just a minute. And the words of John 15, beginning with verse 18, come flowing out. If the world hates you, keep in mind that it hated me first. If you belong to the world, it would love you as its own. As it is, you do not belong to the world, but I have chosen you out of the world. That is why the world hates you. And on he goes, and we are conditioned for this enemy of Jesus and of us as his followers. You know, what's amazing is not that there's an enemy, it's the way Jesus meets the enemy. You see, the mission of Jesus reflects the power of conviction and awareness. What do you do if you know someone doesn't like you? Do you go out of your way to run into them? All right, well, some of us may, okay? Or do you try to avoid them? What if someone's trying to unseat your position or maybe take your job at work? Do you do what you can to try to reaffirm your job and secure your position? That's a pretty natural way to react, isn't it? But when the rolling tide of opposition is coming towards Jesus, he's not avoiding it. It's as if he's moving towards it. You know, as this story unfolds, being followers of Jesus, because that's what we are, right? Who could fault us for standing outside and throwing rocks at the walls where inside there's such insidious plotting going on? We are offended at what they're doing and what they are saying about Jesus, aren't we? Spiritual leaders are supposed to lead, right? They're not supposed to pull away into a corner and scheme ways to reaffirm their position. They pray. That's what spiritual leaders do. They pray. And that's what these guys are supposed to be. Spiritual leaders. They pray. They look for answers because when you're a leader, sometimes the answers just aren't there. You're looking for them, right? So they pray. They look for answers. But now we move from the enemy without to the enemy on the inside. Now, people who go to church are good people. Wouldn't you agree? That's very reaffirming, isn't it, for those of us in church? Good people go to church. How can you hang out with Jesus in close proximity to Jesus and not be transformed by Jesus? You see, even followers of Jesus make a decision as to the degree of his influence in their life. Going to church doesn't make you church. Amen? Praying doesn't ensure that you have good communication with God. Hearing stories of love and forgiveness does not mean that your life becomes a life descriptive of a loving and forgiving heart. You know what it takes to be transformed by Jesus? We got to give him space inside. We talked a lot about inviting the Spirit. Listen, the Spirit transforms us, but from the inside out. What is seen on the outside is supposed to be a reflection of what is happening on the inside, right? Don't you wish Jesus had said something like that at one point? Oh, he did. He did. Luke said, Satan entered Judas. Space. When we bought our first house, the realtor who sold us the house was a good friend. After we closed the deal, we said to her, we don't have enough furniture or junk to fill up this house. To which she replied, don't worry, you will. Guess what? She was right. When we broke up services this morning, we took a tour of your garage or of the closets in your house. Skipping a few heartbeats, aren't we? You have any trouble filling up space? Do you have somebody in your family that is not only proficient at filling their space but also filling yours? See, the truth is the space is going to be filled. Now, Luke says Satan entered Judas. Judas had space that had to be filled. Now, what Judas could have done is redevoted himself to Christ. What Judas could have done is instead of taking the 30 pieces of silver, which incidentally, a couple of historic background ideas for the 30 pieces of silver. 30 pieces of silver was the amount paid to a slave owner whose slave was gored by a bull and killed. Old Testament. 30 pieces of silver is also found in Zechariah as the price that is put on a shepherd for the services rendered. And in the context of Zechariah 11, I think the point is that the shepherd, Israel being the sheep, being the flock, right? The shepherd was God. And it is clear from the context that the 30 pieces of silver is an insulting price. It's an expression of low value. So whenever they say to Judas, we'll give you 30 pieces of silver, while on the one hand they may be saying, this guy is really making our life hard. On the other hand, they're saying, this guy is not very valuable to the people. Now I know you and I have a high appreciation for Jesus, and rightly so. But he wasn't sold out as someone of high value. He was sold out as somebody of low value who wasn't worthwhile. Does that bother you? It does me. But it's true. 30 pieces of silver, he was sold out. Well, it's Tuesday, now going to Wednesday, leading up to Christ's crucifixion. And, well, it's decision-making time. Money or the Messiah? Have you ever bought something that you later regretted buying? Like maybe every Christmas? Have you ever made a deal that you wish you could undo later? You know, regret settles in. Regret's even going to settle in, at least to some extent, for Judas, right? I mean, I don't know how else we explain his panic response and taking his own life. I mean, there is some, it seems like some regret that's going to settle in for Judas, but not right now. You know what Judas is focused on right now? He's focused on earning the money he has been paid, 30 pieces of silver. May not be a lot of money, may not be a huge amount of money. But he's got to fulfill the job that he's been paid to do. That's what you do ethically. If someone hires you to do a job, you earn your pay. Amen? I mean, one of the values that we appreciate in our society is you earn what you are paid. And one of the things that we become very frustrated about is when people are paid to do a job and they don't do it. They don't earn it. But where do the ethics go whenever the requirement for finishing the job is selling out a trusted friend? You see, in the future for Judas is not better days and deeper faith. A relationship with Jesus going forward is in our hands. In the Bible, there's this tension between basing your life on flesh and focusing on spirit. Now, I want you to hear this. This is important. Because it doesn't matter whether you look at Galatians or you look at Romans, understanding the context for Paul of flesh is very important. He's not talking about basing your life on doing immoral things. Those may follow. He is talking about basing your life on being able to make decisions, your own decisions, independent of anybody else or God, making decisions as what's valuable or what's not valuable. And when you and I are left and we depend on the flesh and our own ability in order to make those decisions, eventually immoral conduct and a lot of other bad things are going to follow. When our life is based on flesh, it ends up in disaster and deception. But when it's based on the Spirit, we invite the Spirit of God to come in and to transform our life from the inside out. How many of us here have traveled out towards West Texas and know what the Cap Rock is? Beautiful, isn't it? We can talk about tumbleweeds in West Texas, but the Cap Rock's gorgeous. So maybe you've come upon the Cap Rock, or maybe you've stood on a mountain in Colorado, or maybe you've stood along the coast somewhere in the Caribbean. And those are not neutral situations. They evoke a response from us. That is a natural thing to do. And what we discover is that Jesus is not a neutral figure. That his life, his presence, his mission, and his demands upon us bring from us some sort of decision. Now, for some of us, it may be saying, he doesn't matter. Jesus doesn't matter. But he does matter. And we matter to him. We matter to him. Maybe we look at our lives and we've committed so many mistakes. And we see the future and it's so hopeless that we've given up on Jesus. We've also given up on self. And if that's where we are, watch this. Jesus is not a neutral figure. It's Wednesday. It's Wednesday. The time is nearing for the Passover feast. The crucifixion is just around the corner. And we'll wake up to find out that the tomb has been rolled back and that the grave is empty. But today, the question is this: do we choose the Messiah? Or do we choose the money? If you've got Andy to come on together, we stand and sing.